You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When the CIA was created in 1947, its mission was to gather intelligence on foreign governments. But the CIA's role has been expanded since September 11, 2001, and the line between who's a spy and who's a soldier has become blurred. Mark Mazzetti, the Pulitzer Prize-winning national security correspondent for The New York Times, reports on this transformation in his latest book, The Way of the Knife, The CIA, A Secret Army, and a War at the Ends of the Earth. He was on our show this past April. It was a fascinating conversation, and we are re-airing it for you today as we start this long holiday weekend. I began by mentioning Raymond Davis, an American working for the CIA in Pakistan, who in 2011 was arrested for shooting two men in Lahore. At first glance, it should be just a footnote to the story he tells in his book, but it becomes much more, and I ask Mark Mazzetti, what happened to Raymond Davis, and how did he run afoul of the Pakistani authorities?
First off, the Raymond Davis story became sort of a footnote overshadowed by the bin Laden raid, which happened a couple months later. So in America, it's kind of been forgotten. But when I traveled to Pakistan last year, I realized how much of a bigger deal in Pakistan it is, and how much Raymond Davis is sort of the boogeyman on the streets. What happened was Davis was a contractor working for the CIA, former Special Forces officer, and he was in Lahore working with a team of CIA officers who were tracking down a militant group in Pakistan called Lashkar-e-Taiba, which historically has ties to Pakistan's intelligence service called the ISI. He, in late January 2011, he was driving his car through the streets of Lahore, was approached by two men. According to him, they were brandishing weapons. He shot both men. And then when he tried to get help from the American consulate, a car showed up and started driving down the wrong way of a one-way street and killed a third person, a Pakistani man on a motorcycle, and then drove away, leaving Davis by himself. And he ends up in jail in Lahore. What happened then was an intense effort by the United States government to get Davis out of jail. And one of the things I recount in the book and an excerpt in the New York Times Magazine is the divisions and the fights inside the U.S. government about the strategy. The initial strategy was sort of cobbled together by the CIA, which was stonewall the Pakistani government. Don't tell them what Davis was doing or who he was. He was, quote, a diplomat. And diplomats have diplomatic immunity, and anything they do is protected under diplomatic immunity.
But he was a contractor working for the CIA. Does that make him a diplomat? I'm not even sure what a contractor working for the CIA is. He's not really a government official, is he?
No. So he was working as a part security guard for CIA officers. He also did some what they call route surveillance, which is driving around cities for doing advance work for CIA officers before they're going to meet a source. He checks the scene out to make sure that that it's safe. So it is CIA work. He was not a diplomat. However, he was admitted to the country on a diplomatic passport. And one of the things that this episode revealed, was just how many people the United States had slipped into Pakistan under the nose of the Pakistani government who weren't doing diplomatic work.
In the spy novels, the KGB always has a lot of people with diplomatic passports, but we do the same thing.
We do the same thing, and as I recount, from about 2009 on, the U.S. decided to do more and more work in Pakistan independent of the Pakistani spies. So that meant getting them into the country under these false identities.
Now, after Osama bin Laden was killed, the Pakistani response was kind of odd. They actually came down hard on some people who had helped in locating Osama bin Laden. Do you think that's partly a fallout from what happened here?
Yes, Davis affair was the beginning of the a year of a whole year that basically fractured the U.S. relationship. You had the Davis affair, the Bin Laden raid, and then in the fall you had an American airstrike at the border that killed a group of Pakistani troops. So it was U.S.-Pakistani relations have never recovered from that year. Your question about the response, the Bin Laden raid was an incredible embarrassment to the Pakistan's military. The military is the most important institution in Pakistan, and the idea that a group of Americans could go in, kill Osama bin Laden, get out of the country, being totally undetected by the Pakistani military, was this incredible source of embarrassment. At the same time, the Pakistani military and intelligence service had to answer very tough questions about, well, did they know that bin Laden was hiding there?
What were the traditional dividing lines between the CIA and the military, and what are they today?
There are, if you look at before 9/11, the CIA had, for really a generation, gotten out of the killing business. We know about the early CIA assassination attempts against Fidel Castro and all those things that came to light in the 1970s.
They were going to try to kill Lumumba as well, but the Belgians got there first.
Exactly. And so all of this dirty laundry came out in the 70s, so the Church Committee investigations. After that, a generation of CIA officers came into the agency and were basically trained in traditional espionage, and we're basically taught the CIA doesn't kill people. Like, we're out of that business. The military has always had military intelligence, but they did not do a whole lot of human spying on the ground before 9/11. So after 9/11, you see the lines really blurring, where the CIA is given new authorities to go out and kill. Capture and kill al-Qaeda operatives, and they begin to do that. And the Pentagon, under Donald Rumsfeld, who was furious that he didn't have the power to do what the CIA could do, go around the world, began to expand his authorities for spying.
So there was competition going on between the CIA and the Pentagon.
There was a lot of competition, and there were especially if you just looked in Afghanistan, there was a lot of lack of coordination. There were people doing missions against targets who actually had been turned by the CIA a couple of days earlier. So it was a little bit of a free for all in the beginning.
But at this point, when George Bush took office in 2000. It was years after the end of the Cold War. Had the CIA become a very different kind of agency, forgetting about the ban on assassinations?
What did they
see their mission as?
Well, it had. I mean, they had seen their mission as traditional espionage, which is running agents, foreign agents, to steal secrets of foreign governments, and then taking those secrets, analyzing them, writing up reports, informing the president about what's going on in the world. That's the sort of bread and butter CIA work.
They were supposed to catch the 9/11 attackers as a result of that kind of work.
Right. And one of the things you saw in the 1990s was as a result of the end of the Cold War and the so-called peace dividend, the CIA's budget was dramatically cut back. They closed overseas stations, and they really – under the Clinton administration, I think there was this real question of, well, why, do we need a CIA anymore after the end of the Soviet Union? Now, in the couple years before 9/11, there was a core group of people in the CIA, in the Counterterrorism Center, who became pretty obsessed with bin Laden and al-Qaeda. And those people, after 9/11, really came to the forefront and began running these secret wars.
And you call that Counterterrorism Center the agency's beating heart. Is identifying and eliminating terrorist threats the major mission of the CIA nowadays?
It certainly has been the CIA's number one priority under two successive presidents. So you have both Bush and Obama giving the CIA its top mission of hunting and killing. So when I say that this Counterterrorism Center is the beating heart, I trace a little bit of the history of the Counterterrorism Center. But on 9/11, it was still this relatively small, somewhat obscure part of the agency that was not considered the best place for career advancement. If you were going to the CTC, you were you might be a good officer, but you were not maybe destined for the highest levels. Well, now it's expanded, and it's the central part of the mission.
My guess is Mark Mazzetti, his book, The Way of the Knife, The CIA, A Secret Army, and a War at the End of the Earth. What kind of permission and approvals did the CIA need to begin not just gathering intelligence on terrorist suspects, but eliminating them?
Shortly after the September 11th attacks, within a week, President Bush signed a what they call a secret finding, a presidential finding. And what that does is it authorizes a covert action for the CIA.
So it eliminates everything that came out of the Church Commission and Gerald Ford's decision to ban assassinations.
Now, technically, under the laws put in place after 9/11 or findings by the Justice Department, these killings are not technically assassinations. The assassination is defined as killing off a political leader. The way it was defined in al-Qaeda and the congressional authorizations given to both the Pentagon and the CIA was that this is war and the killings are battlefield killings. You are killing people on a battlefield.
Well, then that would be the military's role.
Well, that's right. And so the CIA was given a military job. And it was a it is all basically how a lawyer will define something. A lawyer can define torture in a certain way and can define assassination in a certain way. And the way that these authorities were written, which were very broad after 9/11, was that the president authorized the CIA and Congress authorized the military to go hunt al-Qaeda because these are military targets.
Now, how much was the president involved? You write about a meeting with CIA officials and Vice President Dick Cheney and his aides in the fall of 2001. What happened at that meeting?
This was a meeting a couple months after 9/11. It was shortly after the CIA got these new authorities, and the CIA was trying to sort of figure out what it could do with these authorities. And I mean, they were in some ways sort of starting from scratch. So this proposal that got brought to Cheney and his team was to have a group of, for lack of a better term, hit squads that would be cobbled together and sent to various countries into populated cities, what have you, that could identify targets and kill them.
Well, Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld are buddies. Well, were buddies anyway. Their careers were tightly linked. But this seems to be going against his friend, isn't it? How much was the Secretary of Defense aware of the shift in power and the growing authority of the CIA?
Well, it's a good question. You're right. They were very close. And what the CIA had immediately, so if we're talking about the first year after 9/11, the Bush administration really did turn to the CIA as its go-to force. They were the first into Afghanistan. They were the first to be recognized to go around the world to hunt, capture, kill al-Qaeda operatives. It took the Pentagon some time to expand these authorities, and certainly the White House was very approving of expanding these authorities. But the Pentagon on 9/11 was still basically a Cold War era institution.
Have things shifted? After all, the Navy SEALs are the group that went and killed Osama bin Laden. They're part of the military.
Yeah, and it's one of the things starting under Rumsfeld and expanded since he left is that the capabilities of special operations troops have dramatically improved and in a number of ways. Not only did they get a lot bigger budgets, they got more people, but they also probably most importantly, they got the authorities to go into countries where soldiers don't normally go. And that's where you saw the Navy SEALs going into Pakistan and the bin Laden.
We also have Delta Force.
Sure. And they're part of a group called Joint Special Operations Command, which I write a lot about in the book. And they are this cadre of Navy SEALs and Delta Force operatives who perform these missions far outside of war zones.
So Donald Rumsfeld expanded the Pentagon's intelligence support activity, its spy program. Is there cooperation and information sharing between these various organizations? Which was a problem in the past, wasn't
yeah,
it?
There is certainly better cooperation and collaboration today than there was in the early years after 9/11. And one of the things that I write about is this period of time in 2005 and 2006 when basically everyone's running over each other. The Rumsfeld sending spies into foreign countries without telling the CIA officers in those countries. And there was a lot of really bad blood. And basically they sort of had a detente where the Pentagon and the CIA got together and they said, all right, in your country, in this country, the CIA will be in charge and military people will be under CIA authority. And in other countries, the Pentagon will be in charge. So I use this term that the way people describe it is soldiers are sheep-dipped as spies. So in a place like Pakistan, if they need to send Navy SEALs, they can just declare them CIA officers or CIA operatives, and they're operating under CIA authority. And that's what happened, actually, in the bin Laden raid.
So what happened during the Bush years has been expanded under the Obama administration?
Certainly, a great many things that began under the Bush administration have been embraced and expanded by Obama. If you look at these types of authorities that the military got, if you look at the drone targeted killing operations have been expanded. So there is a lot of continuity.
My guest is Mark Mazzetti, M-A-Z-Z-E-T-T-I, a national security correspondent for The New York Times. And in 2009, he shared a Pulitzer Prize for reporting on the intensifying violence in Pakistan and Afghanistan and Washington's response. His book, The Way of the Knife, The CIA, A Secret Army, and A War at the Ends of the Earth, published by Penguin Press, will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with a conversation I had in April with Mark Mazzetti, who was here to discuss his book, The Way of the Knife, The CIA, A Secret Army, and A War at the Ends of the Earth. We're re-airing that interview for you today. I began the second part of our conversation by asking him, why this title, The Way of the Knife?
It's a departure from an analogy used by John Brennan, the CIA director, who used to be President Obama's senior counterterrorism advisor. He was giving a speech and sort of comparing the big wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, where the United States uses the hammer, to these wars out of the war zones where they use a scalpel. And as I write in the book that using scalpel implies a surgical way of doing business without costs or complications, and I didn't think that quite captured it. So I used knife because knife fights tend to be a lot messier.
Drones have come to symbolize the new way of waging war. When was the first Predator drone used to kill a terrorist suspect, and who was it?
Well, the first drone strike in Afghanistan was shortly after the September 11th attacks. The first drone strike outside of Afghanistan was in Yemen in 2002. And then the U.S. had to stop it in Yemen when the government – when the ruse that had been set up to carry out this drone strike was blown.
Well, do they have to get permission? If the United States is thinking of a drone strike, do they go to the Yemeni government or do they go to the Pakistani government and say we're thinking of doing this? Can we go ahead?
Yes, they do. And what they had to do with Yemen, for instance, was President Saleh of Yemen, who was a partner with the Bush administration and the Obama administration, basically would allow occasional drone strikes. He was given a lot of money and aid to sort of bless these things.
And what would he say when this car suddenly exploded?
There would usually be a cover story. Like I think in the case of the Yemen attack in 2002, I think they said that the gas can in the truck where the person was driving exploded. And in Pakistan, sometimes there's cover stories about a person is making tea on a gas stove and the stove explodes. One of the stories that I recount in the book is about the first CIA drone strike in Pakistan in 2004, and the CIA had been pushing for armed drone strikes for some time, but President Musharraf of Pakistan wouldn't allow them. He'd allow surveillance drone flights, but not targeted killing strikes. And so at the same time, he was dealing with this tribal rebellion in the mountains of Pakistan, led by this figure named Nick Mohammed, who was a Pakistani Taliban leader who also had ties with al-Qaeda, but was not a senior al-Qaeda leader who was on a high-value target list of the United States. He was fomenting this rebellion in the tribal areas. He had humbled and humiliated Pakistani troops. They have a ceasefire with him. The ceasefire is a farce. Nick Mohammed goes back to attacking Pakistani troops. And finally, Musharraf agrees to allow armed drone strikes under the terms of the deal that the CIA kills Nick Mohammed first. And so he becomes the first CIA drone strike in Pakistan. And that sort of got the CIA's foot in the door.
Well, the Pakistani equivalent of the CIA is the ISI, and they seem to often be at odds with the government, the Pakistani government, and definitely at odds with the CIA. Were they also behind the idea of killing Nick Mohammed Wazir?
Yes, they certainly were, and they, because the deal with the CIA was brokered by senior ISI leaders. So at this point, the CIA and the ISI are actually working fairly closely together. And one of the narrative threads I take through the book is the sort of arc of this relationship that starts out actually fairly not, you know, spies never really totally trust each other, but they can at least respect each other and work with each other. That in this early period, there's pretty good relations. By the end, Raymond Davis, Bin Laden, the relationship's over.
The Pakistani government's no longer taking credit for these
correct.
Things.
That's correct.
Listeners may have read that article you wrote in the New York Times this last weekend about this event. When this whole thing started, were there any questions raised internally in the government about the morality and legality of these extrajudicial killings?
There certainly were questions before 9/11. And one of the things I write about is how much there was this sort of morality play inside the CIA before 9/11 about whether they should basically kill Bin Laden and whether they should kill al-Qaeda and whether this generation of CIA officers who came in after the Church Committee and had risen to senior leadership levels were comfortable with killing again. Now, after 9/11, these questions really were swept aside, and there were very few questions asked about. I mean, the real questions were why didn't you stop 9/11? So the pendulum swung back in the other direction. Now it should be noted that in the first few years after 9/11, the CIA was much more in the capture business and interrogation business than in the killing business, and the strategy really was to capture senior al-Qaeda leaders with the help of the Pakistanis or the Yemenis or whomever and put them in these secret prisons, subject them to these techniques like waterboarding. And a very critical moment comes in 2004 when the CIA's inspector general does this pretty withering report about abuses in the CIA prisons. And it led to all this concern in the CIA that, you know, perhaps they're going to get prosecuted for war crimes or for torture, that's actually happens just 1 month before Nick Mohammed is killed in Pakistan. And so I use that as a moment to sort of show the shift in the CIA strategy from capturing to killing.
In fact, we talked about the tension between the CIA and the Pentagon, but there was also tension between the FBI and the CIA. The FBI was saying, hey, we don't use those kinds of interrogation methods, and we've been very effective. It sounds to me like the U.S. government was at war with itself.
It was. And the question of why the CIA got into this interrogation and became jailers is an odd story that some have gotten to the bottom of, but it's not a traditional mission for them at all.
My guest is Mark Mazzetti of the New York Times. His book, The Way of the Knife, The CIA, A Secret Army, and a War at the Ends of the Earth, is published by the Penguin Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. The CIA is authorized to use drone strikes only against, quote, specific senior operational leaders of al-Qaeda and associated forces. that were involved in the September 11th attacks, who are plotting imminent violent attacks on Americans. But McClatchy reports today that U.S. intelligence reports reveal that drone strikes have been used against others, members of extremist groups, low-level militants in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Are you surprised by that?
No. It was a very good story. I saw it. And certainly the bar has lowered significantly in terms of who constitutes a target. It's not just a lot of senior al-Qaeda operatives in Pakistan, well, because many of them have already been killed. The groups that the CIA targets in Pakistan are groups like the Haqqani Network, which is responsible for some cross-border attacks into Afghanistan. So in that way, it's sort of a it's sort of an extension of the military's war in Afghanistan. The CIA is waging it from the other side. There are attacks against Pakistani Taliban, which are different than the Afghan Taliban. The Pakistani Taliban are fighting Pakistan's government. So in some ways, there's a little bit of a quid pro quo where the U.S. attacks Pakistan's enemies in order to also be able to attack America's enemies.
Now, you mentioned the detention and sites and the interrogation program that a report by John Helgerson, was it?
Helgerson.
Helgerson. Expressed concern that the CIA officers could face criminal prosecution for their interrogation methods. So have drone strikes become the better alternative? Just kill the terrorists rather than capture them and engage in these kinds of interrogations?
Well, it's certainly become the accepted alternative. There have been hundreds of drone strikes in Pakistan, Yemen, elsewhere. And the Republicans and Democrats in Congress have always been very supportive of these things, as opposed to some of the interrogation methods that were aired in 2003 and 2004. It is seen as a politically risk-free strategy for the CIA in many ways because they've got so much support. I mean, one of the things I write about is that the CIA is this inherently paranoid institution that will always be convinced that they will be blamed for everything. And in many ways, they have been throughout the last 60 years. But in this case, the drone strikes still have a great deal of support, and it seems, just based on polling data, a great deal of support among Americans.
Now, we started by talking about Raymond Davis, who was a contractor. The CIA's been using a lot of contractors, haven't they, especially Blackwater, which I don't know its current name, but it's changed its name a couple of times.
It has.
So can you tell us about Enrique Prado and his plans for Blackwater?
So Enrique Prado was one of the two individuals who was briefing Cheney at that meeting in late 2001. And Prado was a senior member of the Counterterrorism Center. He had a CIA history. He fought in some of the Central America wars in the 80s and rose up through the ranks of the Counterterrorism Center. In 2003, he left the CIA to go to Blackwater, the private security firm. And then, very interestingly, he ends up convincing the CIA, or the CIA was okay with it, to basically outsource the program back to him. The program that he had developed at the CIA, he ends up sort of running at Blackwater.
But that was in the move to privatize everything during the Bush administration.
There was a move, and the CIA was incredibly stretched by the demands of these various wars they were waging. So a company like Blackwater came along and they became the sort of indispensable company.
Until they were a source of embarrassment.
Yeah, certainly they became incredibly—
What are we doing now? Are we using contracting other people?
Absolutely. The CIA is using contractors. The military is using contractors. There are plenty of companies the U.S. outsources basic intelligence missions. I mean, we're not just talking about hunting. We're talking about spying. We're talking about gathering intelligence analysis, the sort of core functions of the CIA and other intelligence agencies in some ways are being conducted by companies.
One of the more interesting or fascinating clandestine CIA plans you write about is one that involves developing video games that people in the Middle East would play on their mobile phones. Why Why would this do? What would the what could the CIA use these games for?
Actually, this was a it was a Pentagon operation that that the Pentagon's abilities to spread influence and spread propaganda around the world expanded as the CIA's atrophied. So one of these plans was to use these sort of front companies to build mobile video games that could be downloaded by people around the Middle East, in Iraq, wherever. And some of it was just very innocuous. It was to the video games sort of carried pro-American messages, and you might be able to influence the user of the game. But at the same time, you would go to websites to download the games, and you could then track who was using the games, who was downloading the games, and all of this information could get fed into databases. This actually did happen. The Special Operations Command was doing this kind of work under the sort of broad umbrella of information operations.
John Brennan, the new director of the CIA, who was President Obama's counterterrorism advisor, said he's concerned about the action the CIA has been taking. There's been talk about putting the drone program under the authority of the Pentagon. Do you think that'll rein in the CIA?
Well, it'll be interesting to see what happens. There are Brennan has certainly made has indicated that he would like to see the CIA get out of some of this paramilitary business. Now, Brennan has been very much at the forefront of the drone activity of the last 4 years in his previous job at the White House. I think that my own personal view is that it is going to take some time. It could take years. I think the CIA may give up some drone functions, but in places like Pakistan, I still see the CIA carrying out these missions, partly because Pakistan's government doesn't ever want them acknowledged, and it's easier to keep things a secret under the CIA.
What about the concerns of the Helgerson report? Do you think CIA agents who were involved in torture will face criminal charges? The White House and the Department of Justice approved those methods, didn't they? Won't that protect the CIA?
Well, the CIA was broadly protected by the fact that the Justice Department did sign off on these interrogation methods. Now, Eric Holder, the Attorney General, also opened and I believe is now closed an investigation into other abuses, like what they called freelancing at these sites. So things outside of the normal interrogation methods. There were a number of deaths that occurred in the prisons. They were investigating those, and those would not have been those CIA officers would not have been protected for those for those acts.
So we still may see some people brought up on charges?
I think it's very unlikely, and I do believe actually most of those cases have been closed.
So the two things to go into are either torture or banking, it seems to me, and you make Eric Holder, and Eric Holder will be your friend. Mark Mazzetti's latest book is The Way of the Knife, The CIA, A Secret Army, and A War at the Ends of the Earth. It's published by the Penguin Press. Thank you so much for being on our show today.
I appreciate you having me.